From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jeff Robinson, and this is City Views. Two-thirds of Utah is owned by the federal government, but opinions about whether the federal government's management of these public lands is an asset or a burden sharply differ across the state. In a move that's been dubbed the new Sagebrush Rebellion, the Utah legislature passed a law this year demanding nearly all those lands be transferred to state control by the end of 2014. Supporters like Representative Roger Barris say it will help fund Utah's public schools. Opponents like Western writer Stephen Trimble say it will devastate our national treasures. We'll talk with them both. Plus, you might not spend too much time thinking about noise pollution, even if it's all around you. Now, Salt Lake County is looking to tweak its noise pollution controls and wants you to weigh in. We'll find out what these changes would mean for the community. That plus your calls coming up right after the news. Good morning, I'm Jeff Robinson, in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. It's being called the new Sagebrush Rebellion. This legislative session, Utah lawmakers passed a bill requiring the federal government to relinquish control of nearly all of its public lands in the state by the end of 2014. Supporters say Utah's Enabling Act granting it statehood backs up that effort, but opponents, like my first guest today, say it puts Utah on a path to privatize its national and international treasures. Stephen Trimble is a naturalist, teacher, and author of Bargaining for Eden, The Fight for the Last Open Spaces in America. He joins me now in the studio to provide his perspective. And good morning, Stephen.
Hi, Jeff.
Listeners, join us on the air with your questions and comments on the new Sagebrush Rebellion. Does Utah deserve to control these public lands? We're at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We welcome your questions and comments this morning. Stephen, to start off, who would you say the public lands that make up 66% of Utah actually belong to right now?
Well, it's been long established that those are public lands. They belong to all of us. They belong to all Americans. You know, we did our very best to give them away. We started back in the 1800s with the Homestead Act and opened up the West for settlement. And we gave away 214 million acres under the Homestead Act from 1862 to 1923. Mm-hmm. And we kept passing law after law after law, doing our best to give away the resources, the timber, the minerals. We changed the rules a little bit under the Desert Land Act, but for the very first time acknowledging that this is a dry place, and gave away even more. And in the 1870s, John Wesley Powell began to rein us back just a little bit. And he looked at this West that we live in, this place that we love, and he said, you know, this is too dry for the standard 160 acres that we imagined was the perfect homestead. He suggested 2,560 acres per settler, and no one paid any attention. And so what was left after this long period of disposal are the lands that the federal government manages for all Americans.
What do you think is the value of these public lands and also the value of them being managed by the federal government versus the state or somebody else?
You know, that's the fundamental question, Jeff. What we have in this discussion that has been initiated by the legislature really restarted after the same discussion has come up over and over again, right from the 1800s, is a fundamental difference in values. Here in Utah, there's just a fierce sense that land is a commodity and that growth is always good. And is land a commodity, just another possession to generate income? Or the opposing view is land inseparable from our roles as thoughtful, ethical human beings, forever woven into the web of living things and the physical world that sustains us? You know, that is the question. And the federal government acts on behalf of the public. We call it the public trust. They hold this land in trust for us. And federal agencies are drastically underfunded, but I believe that they really do act on behalf of the public interest in a far more effective way than smaller interests can act, states, corporations, individuals.
Do you see our public lands being there for a wide variety of uses. There's always the conflict between multiple uses. There's recreation, certainly agricultural operations as well, certainly, or just observing them, in their natural beauty. What do you see the role of public lands, and do you see them as being there for all people and all types of uses, Stephen?
Well, the land that the legislature has asked for is 30 million acres of land administered by the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service. And those are multiple-use lands. They aren't asking for permanent ownership of national parks. They want the national parks returned to the states, but after some sort of review of the resources in those national parks, they pledged to return the national parks and designated wilderness back to the people of the United States, who, of course, always had that land. You're going to have to ask that question again. I've lost my train of thought.
Oh, sure. Do you see the public lands as being there for
multiple
all
use.
Those uses, mm-hmm. for agriculture, for people who use ATVs and that sort of
sure.
thing?
Sure. And so the land that the state is asking to take over, to manage as the state of Utah, these are multiple-use lands. The Enabling Act for the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management talk about all of those uses as appropriate on those lands. But the key to that is that multiple-use has different emphases. You can emphasize access from motor vehicles, but you could also emphasize conservation. And this Public Lands Commission that's written into the bill that the state of Utah imagines managing 30 million acres of land, I'm afraid their emphasis on multiple use would be quite different from the emphasis of the Forest Service or the BLM, at least in theory, in their enabling acts, and is likely to emphasize development over conservation. All of those uses are appropriate and must be balanced delicately in this dry and fragile, ecologically fragile place that we live in. You know, the argument from the state is Utah has been put in a different category than all the states in the East who were able to privatize
right.
the land that they received at statehood. And the difference is we are the second driest state in the Union. You know, there's a direct correlation between the acreage of public lands that remain in any given state and the dryness of the state. You know, there just aren't a lot of resources. There's not a lot of water out there. Two-thirds of Utah is public land. We're the second driest state. 83% of Nevada is public land, and Nevada is the driest state.
This is City Views on KCBW. I'm speaking with author and naturalist Stephen Trimble about Utah lawmakers' efforts to regain control of public lands from the federal government. Later this hour, we'll be speaking with Centerville Representative Roger Barris about the same issue. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. So, Stephen, what then do you think lawmakers' intentions are in demanding control of these public lands from the federal government?
Well, that's a good question. I think that this goes right back to the founding of the Republic. You know, we've had a tension between federalism and states' rights from the very beginning. And every few decades, that comes up again. And we went through this long era of disposal when we did our best to privatize and settle the West. And then we gradually pulled back from that. You know, by the end of the 19th century, there were 3 million head of sheep grazing the Wasatch Range in the Salt Lake Valley because we had turned everyone loose. And when a range specialist looked at that unmanaged range in 1902, he saw complete deforestation, brushlands grazed to dust, eroded roads, mine tailing piles, environmental collapse. Beginning at the formation of the Forest Service, in the first national forest in Utah in 1906, we began to pull back. We began to manage those lands. And it took us decades. We kept disposing of lands right through the 1920s. But then in the 1930s, we began to pass federal legislation that managed these lands, starting with the Taylor Grazing Act. And every time we passed a new series of legislation, the people who are the power elite in the West, who tend to believe in growth and development without regard to anything else, attacked the federal legislation. And we had the Sagebrush Rebellion in the 1980s following the passage of the Clean Air Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act, all under the Republican administration of Richard Nixon. So the supporters of these bills, the law that we've just passed in Utah, the law signed by Governor Herbert, claim that we must wrestle with a burden of bureaucracy and regulation. And I would suggest that same bureaucracy and those same regulations have cleaned up pollution and saved the lives of citizens. We have brought species back from the brink of extinction. We've preserved irreplaceable habitats. And gradually, the agencies, the land management agencies, are headed into ecosystem management rather than disposal. So there's this fundamental urge toward, you know, get out and give us more money. That's what the Western states always say to the federal government. Get out of our backyards, get out of our lives, but don't cut off those subsidies. Supporters worry about restrictions on access. You know, what sort of access will citizens have if we privatize public lands? You know, there's a passion for property rights, private property rights. There's a passion for states' rights, and that is driving this from really a pretty extreme ideological position. That's what we're dealing with here.
Stephen, at his monthly news conference last week, Governor Gary Herbert said there are a lot of misperceptions swirling around this bill, and he specifically made the point, and I looked in the legislation, that it says if the land were to be sold to private hands from the state, assuming the state were to regain control of them, 95% of the proceeds would have to go to the federal government. It states that right in the bill. So he says the incentive to sell would not be very strong because the state wouldn't be getting much financial benefit from it anyway. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, look at how much money it's going to cost to manage these lands. We're talking about 30 million acres of land. You know, the BLM and the Forest Service alone spend $200 million in Utah to manage those lands. The reason we have those public lands, let me go back to that point, is that they're worthless for economic development. So much of them are worthless. There are millions of acres out there that are much more valuable to the spirit than to the pocketbook.
Well, then it seems like nobody would buy it anyway, even if they tried to sell it.
Well, what they will do is sell everything they can because they're going to have to generate money to manage that land. So imagine that the highest use of the land for the state of Utah's Public Lands Commission is to generate money for schools, which is a noble goal. Well, what they're going to have to do is intense development in places to generate the kind of money they need to manage all those other millions of acres of land. Look at our state park system. We can't even manage a small acreage of state parks in the state with the budget that we have. And the thing that I really worry about, this Public Lands Commission, I don't think is actually thought through. There's no detail in the bill. If the courts were actually to uphold this demand, then we'll have some vague notion of a Public Lands Commission that will take over managing all of these millions of acres of land. You know, we do have a bureaucracy. We have agencies in place that manage with thoughtful attention to conservation. They can be politicized. But nonetheless, I've spent a lot of time interviewing ecologists and climate scientists over the years, and I've learned two bedrock truths about Utah and Western ecology from them. Utah and the Colorado Plateau lie at the crosshairs of climate change, and we are going to need to strategize for resiliency as our environments shift with drought and rising temperatures. That's one of the controlling features of our future management. I don't think the legislature is thinking about that. If we're going to continue to revel in the natural communities that we all love, if we're going to live with large mammals as our companions on Earth, we'll have to maintain the connectivity of those habitats and think about linking isolated refuges and preserves. That's the only way these species can survive. And I'm afraid this Public Lands Commission that the state would use to manage these lands would lead to further fragmentation and further loss of biodiversity.
We're speaking with Stephen Trimble, writer and naturalist. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Stephen, you wrote in a recent op-ed for the Salt Lake Tribune about how the Wasatch Cache National Forest and other protected lands in Utah were initially created. Remind us how that happened and how it's relevant, you think, to this discussion.
Well, again, we go back to the beginning of the 20th century in that period of intense overgrazing, those millions of sheep denuding the Wasatch, taking away the plants that held the soil in place, and we had floods coming down out of the canyons, polluted water, typhoid epidemics in Farmington. You know, we had really tough times. And it was the people of Utah who asked the federal government to set aside these lands and manage them to protect their very lives. The idea for Cache National Forest came out of the County Commission in Logan, in Cache County. And when Teddy Roosevelt came through Utah to proclaim Cache National Forest, he spoke at the Mormon Tabernacle, and the LDS Church supported the formation of those national forests. You know, we've come a long way since then, and I think that what the legislature is doing is looking backwards. You know, these attitudes toward extractive industry as the only way to develop remote rural Utah places are not the only way. You know, the writer Charles Wilkinson calls the folks who drive that look backwards the lords of yesterday. You know, there are alternatives. If we even just go to the county-by-county lands bills, we bring everyone to the table. You know, this future of our public lands demands everyone at the table. And if we sit down together and talk about the places we love, that's an enormously powerful alternative. You know, one of the other op-eds published in the Tribune not long ago mentioned Dan Kemmes, the former speaker of the Montana legislature and the past mayor of Missoula, who has imagined the creation of gigantic land trusts that would turn whole watersheds over to local compacts of states, Indian tribes, and citizens. Now, this is a much more interesting vision of an alternative to strictly federal management. But Kemmes insists on two basic provisos if this is to move forward. The lands remain public in perpetuity, and that the trustees from those gigantic land trusts manage for ecological sustainability. These are words that simply don't appear in the legislative bills that we've passed, which are probably unconstitutional. You know, in some ways, Jeff, our discussion is moot. The legislative advisors to the legislature suggest this is probably unconstitutional. The experts in public lands law up at the University of Utah Law School say the same thing. You know, we'd probably have a better legal case if we simply asked for the lands to be returned to the Indian tribes. And if we're trying to honor promises made by the federal government, we've broken treaty after treaty, and there's a great legal case to be made that these lands are actually native lands.
And finally, Stephen, do you sympathize not with the bill itself, but the effort and the motivation behind the bill? Do you sympathize to some extent with the frustration felt over, you know, this idea of Washington, you know, 2,000 miles away, being in control of, you know, 2/3 of this state of Utah? Do you sympathize with that frustration, or do you not feel it at all?
Well, I don't think Washington, 2,000 miles away, is in control. The people in control are the people who live in Richfield and Kanab and Monticello, who work for the federal government, the biggest employer in those counties, longtime residents who are embedded in the local community. I do sympathize with the frustration of the folks who live in rural Utah and can't make a living, and their kids have to move away because they can't make a living. But I don't think that the answer is to privatize those lands. Those lands are economic engines. They attract tourism from all over the world. They generate billions of dollars in money from the outdoor recreation industry. There are ways to deal with the remoteness and frustration and, frankly, poverty of rural Utah. But, you know, 85% of Utahans live along the Wasatch Front, and we have to figure out a way to balance the needs of the rural places with the lands that belong to all Americans and that people come from all over the world to visit. And we've got to sit down together and talk with each other. You know, I was deeply disappointed that Representative Barris wouldn't appear on air with me and talk through these things that we all have to grapple with together. You know, Olympia Snow, the retiring Republican senator from Maine, spoke on the NewsHour last month, and she addressed this directly. She talked about why she's leaving the Senate. And she said, what is the objective of serving in public office? It's problem solving. She recommends being open and listening to the people with whom you disagree, not just to the people with whom you agree. You can't solve the problems if you're not talking to the people who disagree with you. Compromise is not a capitulation of your principles. And so I look forward to more conversations in person with all of us who I think share a love for the land and imagine a better future for us all.
This is City Views here on KCBW. My guest these first few minutes has been Stephen Trimble. He is author of Bargaining for Eden, the fight for the last open spaces in America. We're talking about House Bill 148 and Utah lawmakers' efforts to gain control of federal public lands into state control. And Stephen, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate you being on the show.
I was delighted to be here, Jeff.
This is City Views here on KCBW. We'll be right back. Good morning. I'm Jeff Robinson in for Jennifer Napier Pierce, and you're listening to City Views. We continue our discussion on Utah's public lands and this year's efforts to take control of them from the federal government with Republican Representative Roger Barris of Centerville. He was a co-sponsor of House Bill 148, requiring the transfer of federal lands to Utah by the end of 2014, and the sponsor of a joint resolution also making that demand. He joins me now in the studio to give his perspective on why Utah has the right to gain control of these lands. And Representative, thanks for being here. It's good to have you in the studio.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Listeners, we invite your comments for Representative Roger Barris. Join us on air at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Representative, you wrote in a recent op-ed for the Salt Lake Tribune that the issue of what to do with these public lands in the West goes all the way back to 1780, before the U.S. Constitution was even written. What are you referring to there?
In 1780, the colonies, actually they weren't colonies, they were working together as a federation of states. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were involved in a Revolutionary War with Great Britain. And as these states looked at what they called wastelands to the west, that's what they called them in those days, it was surplus lands, they looked to those as perhaps an opportunity for paying the debt that would come out of the Revolutionary War, but they also looked at this, that there's going to be lands that should be set aside at a future date for the creation of new states. And so this resolution of 1880 was their way of saying, okay, the land that is going to be that we're going to acquire either through cession from the states themselves, or acquisition from other countries, or from what was acquired from Great Britain in the war, these lands would be set aside for the payment of the national debt if they were sold, and secondly for the creation of new states. And so that was the basis, and the Constitution actually used much of that. The resolution of 1780 in the property clause that the United States would have control over these lands for the purpose of paying the debt and for the creation of new states.
And so you feel that this, kind of set a precedent there at the very beginning, that indeed the federal government would not retain control of these lands as it has today.
That's correct. In subsequent Supreme Court cases, a very famous one in 1828 with Chief Justice John Marshall. I'd like to just state a couple of things that he said. He says, The time the Constitution was formed, the limits of the territory over which it was to operate was generally defined and recognized. And these limits consisted in part of organized states and in part of territories, the absolute property and dependencies of the United States. These states, this territory, the future states to be admitted into the Union are the sole objects of the Constitution, and there is no express provision whatever made in the Constitution for the acquisition or government of territories beyond those limits. And so he's coming out and affirming that this land set aside is to be used for the acquisition of the states, and there's nothing set aside for government of those territories beyond those units or those limits. And if I can just go through one more Supreme Court ruling, which mm-hmm. was in 1894, and this was one where it says, upon acquisition of a territory by the United States, whether by cession from one of the states or by a treaty with a foreign country or by discovery or settlement, the same title and dominion passed to the United States for the benefit of the whole people and in trust for the several states to be ultimately created out of the territory. So they were creating a trust in which states would be able to be created. And finally, the Supreme Court in 1845, in the Pollard versus Hagen case, said the United States shall have fully executed these trusts, and the municipal sovereignty of the new states will be complete throughout their respective borders, and they, the original states, will be upon equal footing in all respects. So they looked at this, that there was a trust created by the United States for the, mm-hmm. the creation of new states. And once these states were created, then they would have the same, or they would have sovereignty and be upon equal footing as all of the original states. And so that is the premise. That's where we go back to. And there's even one more statement that I think is very telling. And this is back in 1833 at the time of President Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. And President Jackson, at that point in time, actually, there was the debt for the nation was paid off. And at that point in time, as they were looking at these federal public lands that had been set aside, this is what he said. He says, "I do not doubt that it is the real that it is in the real interest of each and all of the states of the Union, and particularly the new states, that the price of these lands shall be reduced and graduated, and after they have been offered for a certain number of years, the refuse remaining unsold shall be abandoned to the states, not kept by the federal government, but, okay, if we have this dry desert land, rather than retaining it in federal ownership, it should be, at that point in time, abandoned to the states, and the machinery of our land system entirely withdrawn." And then he concluded by saying, "It cannot be supposed that the compacts intended that the United States should retain forever title to lands within the states." Could it be any more clear than that? But of course, at the beginning of the 20th century, as we entered a new progressive era and these large institutions were created to centralize government, the land management became part of that with the development of the Park Service and later the Taylor Grazing Act and later the Bureau of Land Management. And so that is the fallout that is coming, that has come in direct conflict with what the intent of our founders were. And through the 19th century of land disposal, the intent. And when Utah entered the Union in 1896, based upon the Enabling Act compact, which is a promise or a contract with the United States, mm-hmm. the intent was that it entered the Union with the understanding, the implied understanding, as well as what was written in our Enabling Act, that these lands would be disposed, that whether through grants, through sale, but at some point in time, that the lands within the state of Utah and all other states would be within the sovereign domain and control and government of the states, not the federal government.
This is City Views here on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson. I'm speaking with Republican Representative Roger Barris of Centerville. Join us on the air at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And Representative, we do want to take a few calls in just a couple minutes here, but let's go back to the Enabling Act. The chief argument behind this year's House Bill 148 is the belief that the Enabling Act, the document that granted Utah statehood, does require the federal government to dispose of its lands within Utah. You addressed this in your recent op-ed as well. Let's go to that specific part of the document that addresses that issue.
Okay. In that document, if you look at Utah's Enabling Act and compare it with the Enabling Acts of other states that preceded us in statehood and those that came after us, actually, the language is, if not identical, is very similar in that the state of Utah and all other states said forever disclaims title to these public lands. Now, that was the one part of it. The part that a lot of people leave out is until it is disposed, there is still a duty for the federal government to dispose of that land. And of course, during that period, while the disposal is being taken place, whether through grants, through sale, or however it is done, the state of Utah would not have taxing authority over that land. We would not be able to collect property tax. And so that's the issue. The reason for disclaiming title, however, is not just to give up the lands in order to get statehood. It is to give the United States government or Congress clear, clean, unobstructed title so that they will be able to dispose of the land, whether through grants, through homesteading, through sale, but it is to give them clear title so the states could not obstruct that ability to dispose of the land.
Do you think that Enabling Act and this particular section we're talking about is open to interpretation, that various legal minds can come to different opinions on what it actually means, or do you think there really is only one interpretation?
well, let's go back to the old adage, put three attorneys in an office and get five opinions. So yes, there certainly will be different legal viewpoints on this. However, as we have reviewed this with our Attorney General office, there is a very sound legal argument that the federal government has breached its contract or its compact with the state of Utah. It has breached the promises. That is something that has never been litigated in court before as far as this public land management. There's been other aspects of it which have been litigated, but this very, very narrow definition of breach of contract has not, and that's what we're going to look at.
Listeners, join us on the air at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Ingrid is calling from Salt Lake City. Ingrid, what's your question or comment for Representative Roger Barris?
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was wondering, how do these lands get us money for school? The governor has said that there's not a good incentive to sell the land.
Right.
So how is it going to be making money for our schools if they're just left as it is? The law makes me really nervous because it isn't clear what the state intends to do with it if they actually get it.
Interesting question, Ingrid. Representative Barris, you're a co-sponsor of this legislation. How do you respond?
It's a really good question because that certainly is one of the ultimate issues here is the funding of education, although there are others which we are concerned of, one being what we consider to be the mismanagement of the land by the federal government. We can go into that later, as well as the sovereignty and constitutional issues. But as far as funding, the federal lands, which consist of which are about two-thirds of the landscape in Utah, and there are some beautiful landscapes, and they are beautiful. They are treasures to the people of Utah. We would not want to touch those types of things. But there are other lands, especially that have an opportunity for what they call multiple use. And when the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, or FLPMA, in 1976 was created, which actually changed the policy of the United States from that of disposing of the land, which was their duty to do, to retaining and managing the land, it was set up that there would be revenues derived from the land through the multiple use of the land, whether it be grazing, whether it be tourism, whether it be recreation, whether it be the natural resource development, all of these sorts of things. What has happened over the last number of years is this, and we've heard it previously, this ecosystem management. It has changed from conservation and development to ecosystem management. The fact that these lands are no longer looked at as opportunities for developing these multiple uses. And as such, it does have an economic impact on the state of Utah. And one example is if you look at mineral development and energy development in the state, we as a state get about 48% of the mineral lease revenues that would come off from these federal lands. Compare that, however, with a state that does not have to deal with the public lands, where they get 100% of their mineral lease revenues versus we only get the sharecropper portion out of it, if I can put it that way. We're really living in serfdom, if you look at it, that we are subject to a landlord here that is only willing to give us a portion of the resources. So when it comes to funding education, as we can look at the development and responsible and environmentally responsible development of these resources, and the state of Utah would be able to realize the economic benefit of that from having 100% instead of just half of it, that goes a long way in funding our education. And so that's just one aspect of it as well. But we feel that through the multiple use and the sustained yield, as was originally intended through the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, that there can be rising economies, much, much better opportunities for rural Utah to have jobs. Right now, what we see through this ecosystem management is the closure and of access to these areas, not only from the standpoint of developing resources, but even to enjoy the recreation or the tourism. You can't get into many areas of the forests, some areas of the forests now, areas on BLM lands. They close the roads. There is someone sitting there with a gun that is a federal officer saying you can no longer go down these areas. And so I hope that helps answer that question is there will be opportunities for the state of Utah to realize economic gains. There was a time when the federal government came to Utah, I think it was in the 30s, and said, well, we're willing to give you what they call a surface estate, meaning, you know, if you want to use it for grazing and things like that, we'll do that. But we're going to keep a hold of the mineral estate, meaning the energy resources, the mineral resources. Is that a good bargain? Is that the benefit of the bargain that we entered into at this time of statehood, the same bargain that others entered into, where all of those resources were provided to the states? So we just feel that we have been shorted. Many of the western states have been shorted on that.
Ingrid, we appreciate the call. 801-355-8255 is the number. And Representative Barris, you mentioned that the Utah Attorney General, Mark Shurtleff, is very much on your side when it comes to this situation. He believes that it has a great likelihood of being successful in court. Resources have been allocated by the legislature to fight this litigation, but there was a note attached to the bill by legislative attorneys that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it said if you tried to enforce it, there was a high probability it would be declared unconstitutional. How do you get around that?
I'm not the attorney that should be answering that question. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's others that are much better in doing that. But my understanding is what they used in making that decision as far as our legislative attorneys is based upon one particular case and how that case was ruled on by the Supreme Court. It did not address, however, the approach that the state of Utah and the Attorney General's office will be taking as far as look at litigating a breach of contract. So that it did not address that aspect of it at all. And so I honestly think that they missed that aspect of it as we were evolving through the process of putting the bill together. But that's where we have landed, and that's the approach that we're going to be taking.
Representative Barris, I'd like to take another call. This is Sylvia calling from Salt Lake. Sylvia, what's your question or comment for Representative Barris?
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call, and I do appreciate the complexities of land use issues. But I just feel like this is one of those cases where just because you can show a breach of contract through the Enabling Act or other means, that I don't think that means that we should pursue this action. I somewhat resent the time and money and effort going in this direction. I strongly feel that it is not wise to give up the national refuges, to give back the national parks, that was a good development in preserving something that cannot be measured in dollars. I'm frustrated with the Republic, seemingly the majority Republican sentiment here in Utah, that our lands have only value in dollars. And the fact is that they do have value in dollars when you conserve them. And I just feel like if we're conservative, that ought to include conserving our natural beauty, the economic possibilities even of preserving these places for places of conserving ecosystems and conserving plants and animal species.
So, Sylvia, our time is short, but thank you very much for the call. Let's go back to Representative Barris for your response.
I think it's something that was very true that she said, that we do need to preserve these areas that are treasures. And that's why we have put in the bill that the national parks would be excluded from this, that mm-hmm. our wilderness areas, we'll make through the Constitutional Defense Council, which is reviewing all of this, we'll look at the national wildlife refuges, the national recreation areas, the national conservation areas, and all of these things will actually be taken off the table and managed as federal treasures. But let me say one thing, this is not a criticism so much as a reality, and that is that since when have the terms good management and federal government been synonymous? Why is it that the state of Utah cannot manage these lands better than the federal government? We're the local people here. We're the people on the ground. And contrary to what we may have heard in the past, that these are local people with local jobs governing this, it is Washington, D.C. that sets the policy. And primarily, the people from the Forest Service and the BLM, great people, but they take their orders from Washington. And quite frankly, I just want to point out one thing, and that is Even the Forest Service itself, a decade ago in 2002, published a document called The Process Predicament, the problems that they were having in management of the lands. And what it said is the process predicament is beset by a costly procedural quagmire, as they called it, in which perhaps 40% of the direct work at the individual national forest level was now taken up in planning and assessment rather than actual real good work on the ground. These were paperwork activities, which in the end often led to nowhere. And then the agency characterized its own circumstances that they said this: unfortunately, the Forest Service operates within a statutory, a regulatory, and administrative framework that has kept the agency from effectively addressing the rapid declines in forest health, and including the development of explosive wood fuel buildups in many of the western states. Basically, this progressive idea of central control and management of our forests has failed, and they have admitted it themselves, that they are caught up in the statutory, regulatory, and administrative framework that just does not allow for good management. The states do a much better job of that.
This is City Views on KCBW. My guest has been State Representative Roger Barris, a Republican from Centerville, talking about House Bill 148 and the Utah legislature asking for control of federal public lands from the federal government. Representative Barris, it's been a very interesting discussion, and we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation.
This is City Views. We'll be right back. You're listening to City Views on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, filling in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Whether it's annoying neighbors partying into the late hours of the night or the constant drum of machinery, everyone has dealt with noise pollution at some point in their lives. Now, the Salt Lake Valley Health Department is revisiting its own regulations on community noise pollution control. It will hold a public hearing on the issue a week from today and is looking for your comments and input. Joining me now in the studio to discuss it are Dale Keller. He's Bureau Manager for Environmental Health with the Salt Lake Valley Health Department. Dale, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
And we're also glad to have Victor Olives. He is the Salt Lake Valley Health Department Environmental Health Scientist and Industrial Hygienist. And Victor, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, what types of noise pollution are predominant here in the Salt Lake Valley?
Probably the biggest complaints that the health department receives would be issues such as bars late at night, music mm-hmm. issues, amplified sound, those type of things. We get lots of complaints on issues, waste haulers picking up too early in the morning, sweepers near neighborhoods, those type of things would be the common complaints that we enforce on.
Mm-hmm. And what type of noise pollution controls already exist here in Salt Lake County?
Well, since 1984, the Salt Lake Valley Health Department has had a regulation in place. One of the components of that regulation was that it had some issues that were somewhat difficult to enforce. It was based on what's called an LMAX level, which is basically spike noise is in violation. And so our goal with the rewrite of the regulation was to switch that to a more enforceable standard, to an LEQ standard, which is basically time-weighted average, and then have a numerical standard to do so. Another component of the reason for the change was that we had a plainly audible component of the regulation. If you could hear it, then there was a high probability that it was in violation, very, very difficult to enforce. And so we've backed off, and rather than make some changes to the regulation, we've decided that we've had so many substantive changes that we would simply start over, use the other as a base, and go from there. So that's what the hearing is about on the 11th.
So what are the short-term and long-term consequences of noise pollution? You know, why is it important to enforce these regulations, Victor?
Well, noise pollution here in the Valley, mostly what we are dealing is with environmental causes of pollution. So this is not occupational. What we are dealing here is mostly psychological effects. We are not dealing here with physiological effects, as long as there's not an abrupt noise and an explosion that shouldn't even be
right.
happening. So what we are trying to control here is this type of occurrences when a noise is going to be affecting the livelihood and the, you know, the health, the psychological health of the community.
And so does this, do you implement these controls, whether it's, you know, people working at a business or people who have noise complaints inside their own home, all types of areas?
Yes. Actually, we have divided the county in different areas, so industrial, commercial, multifamily, and residential. So all of them are being addressed by different levels of permissible noise. For the most restricted would be in the residential areas, and the less restricted would be in the industrial areas.
So if you happen to live in a home that is in an industrial area, does that mean that the noise controls are more lax, that there can be more noise even if you do happen to live there?
Yes, actually, there's no buffering zones. This is a zoning issue. This is not a health department issue. But there's not clear buffering zones in the valley that will, separate residential from industrial. So, but there's very rare cases where we are going to find industrial nearby residential. Commercial could be happening, but industrial is very rare. And at the end of the day, what we are trying to do is generate a kind of a rule or a guideline for these businesses in order to do best management practices and control their noise. If they are nearby of a residential area, control their noise in the best possible way.
This is City Views on KCBW. We're talking about the Salt Lake Valley Health Department revisiting a noise pollution controls. And we're speaking with Dale Keller and Victor Olives, both with the Salt Lake Valley Health Department. Join us on air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. So I'm curious how these noise pollution controls are actually enforced right now. You know, if I have a complaint and I were to call you up or I were to call up, my local police, how would that be handled?
We would respond whether that's during the daytime or after hours. We have an emergency response group that the health department does. It's very common that we do these enforcements with local policing agencies. And let's use a classic example. The local club has the door open and blasting noise into to near neighborhoods. We would go to the property line of the receiving property, take noise pressure, and document the sound, and then have a case together and move on from there.
And so this is something that it seems, takes some time. If I have a noise complaint, if I have noisy neighbors partying at all hours of the night, it's not something where I might be able to get them to stop right away.
Now, clearly, we're not going to attempt to take the place of police departments for disturbing the peace issues and those type of things. Obviously, they would handle those. When we have a amplified sound or something like that is problematic, where we would need to take sound pressure readings, then we would get involved.
So what are these main changes that you are proposing? It's a pretty lengthy document to go through, but what are the main points of what's being changed and that you'll be holding a public hearing on April 11th about?
Well, clearly the biggest thing that we have is that the regulation now will be based almost solely on numerical standards. If there's a problem, we'll take sound pressure readings. If indeed it's in excess of what is allowable during at that particular zoned area and that time of day, then we would put a case together and do enforcement on it.
How is that different from how it is now?
Right now, we have a major component of the regulation that states plainly audible. If, like at nighttime, you can hear the blowers at the neighborhood car wash going on at night, it's a violation. And we've had some real problems and actually some legal advice that makes this extremely difficult to enforce. There are just so many unique variables. The hearing ability of the receiving individual, we all have different levels of the sound that we would put up with. So it's based now on numerical standards.
And so under the controls right now and under the change, what are, the time, what's the time element in terms of allowable noise from a certain time period and versus allowable noise at night? When does the time period change and how do the acceptable levels change based on the time?
Without question, the most problematic areas that we have, as Victor had alluded to, are those areas where you have a transition from a residential to a commercial area, the local grocery store with the neighborhood around. And so our regulation would reduce sound pressure levels allowed at that area to the receiving property at 11 o'clock in the evening to 7 o'clock in the morning. So say you've got a 7-Eleven or some other facility that has a dumpster there and they were close to a neighborhood, they would not be allowed to service that can except for during the day.
And so these standards that you set, are they kind of a minimum standard? Can Salt Lake City, West Valley City, for example, say, we're going to enforce stricter standards than what you have?
They certainly have the ability to do that. For the most part, the local municipalities have in the past and in most cases will adopt this regulation. The health department has jurisdiction in all the municipalities, but if they decide to have a separate ordinance in their city that is a little more restrictive, then they certainly can do that. I think we've probably met with more municipalities and had more feedback probably the last 6 months of meeting with city councils and community councils and policing agencies just to make sure that we were all on the same page with this.
And our time is short, Dale and Victor, but really quickly remind us about the hearing next Wednesday, the 11th. When and where and how can people weigh in?
Okay. People are welcome to respond to the hearing. It'll be in person at the Salt Lake Valley Environmental Health Building, 788 East Wood Oak Lane, or they can get online at the Health Department website and issue written comments to it, and all of those will be reviewed, and certainly we'll take part in the final decision on the reg.
All right, Victor and Dale with the Salt Lake Valley Health Department, thank you for joining us on City Views. I'm Jeff Robinson. Thanks to Jesse Ellis for his help with the show, and thank you for listening.